content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we'll begin today with an opinion piece. What the Supreme Court Doesn't Get About Homelessness, by Jerusalem Demsis. The Supreme Court has just ripped away one of the rare shreds of legal protections available to homeless people. In a 6-3 ruling, the court has decided that the city of Grants Pass, Oregon, did not violate the Eighth Amendment by enforcing camping bans against its involuntarily unsheltered residents. The ruling epitomizes why housing has become a crisis in so much of the country. It does nothing to make communities confront their role in causing a housing shortage, and it upholds their ability to inflict pain upon that shortage's victims. This ruling overturned the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals precedents, Grants Pass v. Johnson and Martin v. Boise, which had restrained jurisdictions in much of the western United States, including the high homelessness states of California, Oregon, and Washington, from enforcing anti-camping laws if they lacked shelter beds. Writing for the majority in the Grants Pass case, Justice Neil Gorsuch struck a Tocquevillian note, asserting that the American people, through their voluntary associations and charities, their elected representatives and appointed officials, their police officers and mental health professionals, know better than some judges the best way to address homelessness in their cities and towns. And if part of their answer is to jail homeless people, so be it. Modern tent encampments were not a significant part of the urban landscape before the 1980s. In fact, not since the Great Depression, when employment hit nearly 25%, have so many people sought makeshift shelter in outdoor camps. Today, unemployment is at 4%. And yet, in prosperous American cities, homelessness abounds. It's not because drugs were invented in the past several decades, nor is it because mental illness was invented by millennials. Rather, it's because local governments have sought to rid their housing markets of low-income people by getting rid of low-income housing options while ensuring that the rest of the market would become prohibitively expensive. Localities simply displaced the most vulnerable residents to the outdoors, hoping that life would be so uncomfortable that these people would migrate to some other community. And now, after policy choices have created a nationwide housing crisis, cities have successfully petitioned the Supreme Court to allow them to ignore a problem of their own making. If they're not willing to allow more housing, they certainly are willing to house the indigent in jail. Grants Pass has about 40,000 people and a median family income of $54,000, which is 30% below the state average. The one homeless shelter there, run by a Christian nonprofit, can house 138 people. It requires that its residents abstain from alcohol and drugs, including nicotine, attend twice daily chapel services, and abstain from intimate relationships. It also requires residents to separate from their partner or spouse to maintain gender segregation. For many people, this is a difficult way to live. Everybody agrees that there aren't enough shelter beds for the number of homeless people. Where they disagree is what should be done about it. Tent encampments are a symptom of a dysfunctional housing market for low-income renters. Yet over the decades, cities have not only barred housing of last resort from being built, they've also squeezed development of housing targeted at even middle and high-income renters. People's options have thus been whittled down to nothing. When an emergency medical emergency hits, or a divorce happens, or a family dispute leads to someone being kicked out, resulting in large numbers of people living outside. As tent encampments have proliferated around the country, communities have routinely treated the problem of homelessness as a matter of maintaining order rather than of reducing the number of people without shelter. This isn't irrational. Many local residents experience these encampments as hotbeds of disorder. Not only do many encampments take up public parks and settings that are available for general use, but they also accumulate trash and other signs of chaos. Still, fining and jailing people for being poor is fundamentally unjust. And if you're homeless, that on its own should not be treated as a criminal offense. And as a practical matter, people cannot be fined or jailed out of homelessness. When cities turn to punitive measures without offering options for more suitable than camping outside, they're at best simply moving homeless people around in an endless dystopian game. At worst, they're imposing fines and other legal costs on people already defined by their lack of resources, and increasing the likelihood that they remain transient and unhoused. Writing for the three dissenting liberal justices, Sonia Sotomayor zeroed in on a core problem. Does criminalization even work? For people with nowhere else to go, fines and jail time do not deter behavior, reduce homelessness, or increase public safety. Police officers in these cities recognize as much. Look, we're not really solving anybody's problem. This is a big game of whack-a-mole. The ruling will empower cities and states to pursue criminalization without addressing the root causes of homelessness. But to what end? In 2023, the National Park Service cleared about 74 people out of D.C.'s McPherson Square. City officials admitted later that, as the Washington Post put it, roughly two-thirds of those who had been displaced from the park were believed still to be sleeping on the street. The newspaper reported that soon after the sweep, just two people had been placed in permanent housing. Elected officials want an easy way out of this catastrophe, and when your only tool is a police officer, everyone looks like a prisoner. Mayors and governors are searching desperately for a quick fix to this problem and are frustrated that even valiant efforts to increase the supply of affordable housing is unlikely to earn them many points from the electorate. Such attempts to address homelessness are unlikely to be politically persuasive if they don't result in the removal of tent encampments. This frustration was best put by Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass. "Angelinos want tents to go," she continued. "I could build 500,000 units of housing, and if there are still tents, people will not believe that you did anything except steal their money." But there is no quick fix, and mayors such as Bass have done little to seriously push back against the entrenched political interests that oppose new housing. Yes, clearing encampments has to happen sometime, but only when cities have invested in the shelter capacity and housing space needed to serve these populations will enforcement have any meaningful effect on addressing homelessness and the disorder that it brings. Next, I went to Death Valley to experience 129 degrees. Sweating Through One of the Hottest Days in History by Ross Anderson. A large digital thermometer sits at the entrance to the gleaming mid-century modern visitor center at Furnace Creek, California. When I arrived on a Sunday afternoon, it was thronged with people with their phones out taking pictures. A mood of anticipation hummed through the crowd. A few hours east of us in Las Vegas, temperatures would rise to a 120 degrees Fahrenheit, smashing that city's record by 3 degrees. But news reports suggested that here in the heart of Death Valley National Park, the high could reach 130, matching the hottest ever day reliably measured on Earth. At 1 p.m., the big thermometer was already flipping back and forth between 126 and 127. A ranger told us not to get excited, as the thermometer runs a degree or two hot. Our hopes were undimmed. There were still several hours to go before the day reached peak heat. In the meantime, a circus atmosphere was taking hold. I saw a man kneeling close to the ground, surrounded by a camera crew. I edged closer, thinking that he might have caught a scorpion or tarantula, and saw that he had a frying pan instead. He was trying to cook a raw egg in the sun. When the clear and runny part turned white, he brayed at his doubters in triumph. People stood gathered in clusters, wearing floppy hats and neckerchiefs. I heard lots of French and German and a bit of Dutch. Over the years, I've run into as many Europeans in the big Western parks. Europe has no great desert, and as a consequence, its people have become great pilgrims of arid expanses, seekers of heat, space, and light. A trio of Germans took pictures of themselves, pointing to the temperature. I, too, was a tourist, and I, too, had retained a childish enthusiasm for superlatives. I wanted to experience world record heat, not as a number in a headline, but with my body. I'd heard that Death Valley summers were becoming hotter, as they have been for many other places. I imagined my physical person as a kind of tuning fork for planetary change. At 3:18 p.m., the slightly overactive thermometer ticked up to 130. I later saw that, according to the National Weather Service, the temperature was only 129. I was no stranger to the scorching feel of a desert in high summer. My dad lived amid the red rock of southern Utah for more than a decade, and I visited him in all seasons. I was just there a few weeks ago when the temperature reached 113. But 129 hits different. When you emerge into that kind of heat from an air-conditioned space, you feel its intensity before the door even closes behind you. It sets upon you from above. It is as though a clingy gargoyle made of flame has landed atop your head and neck. This gargoyle is a creature of pure desire. It wants only one thing, to bring you into thermal equilibrium with the desert. It goes for your soft spots first, reaching into the corners of your eyes, singeing your nostrils. After a few minutes pass, it tries to pull moisture straight through your skin. You feel its pinches and prickles on your forearms and calves. The breeze only makes things worse by blasting apart the thin and fragile atmosphere of cooled air that millions of your pores produce by sweating. Your heart hammers faster and faster. Your cognition starts to blur. Only 8 minutes in, I looked down at my phone. It had shut down entirely. I chose to view that as an act of solidarity. The next morning, I went for a ride with Nicole Andler, the park's chief of interpretation. She helps visitors understand what they're looking at, so they do more than gawk at the park's spectacular geology. She'd sent me an email a few days earlier to set expectations. We could be outside her vehicle for only 10 minutes at a time, it said. I'd rolled my eyes. I confessed this to her later, thinking that her caution was excessive. But my encounter with the heat the day before we met changed my mind. We drove along the eastern side of the valley in a white Jeep Grand Cherokee. A walkie-talkie in the center console occasionally piped up with bursts of static or number-coded reports called in by other rangers. She pointed to a hill covered in black volcanic rock. She said that in the 1970s, Carl Sagan had used its terrain to test drive a prototype of a rover that later landed on Mars. Death Valley has also stood in for fictional planets. The Tatooine scenes in Star Wars were shot in the park because it was the kind of landscape that could have plausibly been scorched by two suns. We arrived at Badwater Basin, a playa wedged between two mountain ranges that shoot up straight from the valley floor. These mountains aren't thickly forested like the Appalachians. They're the stark, charcoal and brown peaks of the basin and range. The highest among them is 11,000 feet. A deep ice age lake once covered the valley, but after the planet warmed, it evaporated, leaving only trace minerals behind, mostly salt crystals. They lend the playa its distinctive white shimmer. At 282 feet below sea level, the Badwater Basin is the lowest point in North America. There wasn't a single cloud in the sky, not even a cirrus wisp or fading contrail. There isn't much atmospheric cover, and July sunlight slams down into the valley unimpeded for 14 hours a day. The thick air near the bottom absorbs its heat and rises, but not enough to clear the mountains. Instead, the still warm air settles back down to lower elevations and accumulates, an effect that Andler compared to that produced by a convection oven. On certain days, she said, the heat feels like it has drilled through her skin and muscle and into her bones. After a brief spell outside in 120-degree heat, rangers are advised to take anywhere from 15 to 45 minutes to cool down. They do everything they can to shorten these cool-down periods in case they're needed for a rescue or other urgent business, but they have to be careful. Sometimes I get back into a hot Death Valley vehicle, turn the air conditioning on, and start to feel refreshed, only to realize my back is a completely different temperature than my front, Andler said. I pictured the gargoyle smirking at her in the rearview mirror. Death Valley allows its rangers to leave their parked cars running, so they are ready to serve as cooling chambers. The day before I arrived in Death Valley, the rangers had received a distress call from Badwater Basin. A group of six people had ridden motorcycles into the park and were showing signs of heat illness. They were in the front country, and we knew their location, so rangers responded immediately, Andler said. One of them was declared dead at the scene, and not far from Andler, where Andler and I stood on the valley floor. Three others were brought to the visitor center for emergency medical attention, including one who was evacuated to a hospital in Vegas. The evacuation took extra time because the air was too hot to send a helicopter into the park. It's tough when you're on a motorcycle because you're exposed to the elements and you're wearing heavy gear, Andler said. The only thing that I can assume is that they didn't take enough time to cool down. A sad silence passed between us. That night I went to Zabriskie Point to watch the setting sun turn the valley's wrinkled rock formations gold and pink. A crowd of extreme heat tourists had assembled, but Andler's story about the bikers made me feel less festive. After the sun went down, I drove back to Furnace Creek. Desert mice flitted across the road in my headlights. They were the only non-human animals I had seen, apart from a coyote that padded through some sand dunes I visited at sunrise. It took 2 hours for Death Valley to darken. When the moon is full, the park's salt flats take on an eerie glow. But that night the moon was just a thin crescent. It soon became so dark that I couldn't see my own outstretched hand. One of the Milky Way's starry arms arced from one horizon to another. I wanted to stargaze deep into the night, but could only manage a half an hour. At 10:30 p.m., it was still 119 degrees on the valley floor. On my way out of the park early the next morning, I turned onto a private road. I passed a no trespassing sign and made my way onto Timbisha Shoshone land. At a small administrative office, I met with Mandy Campbell, a 50-year-old woman who serves as the tribe's historic preservation officer. We had just sat down to talk when an extreme heat alert lit up both of our phones. I asked Campbell what the tribe made of all the people who come out to the park just for the thrill of experiencing near 130-degree weather in person. We think that they're crazy, she said. We don't understand why they do it. I have a police scanner at home, and it keeps going off. I keep hearing dehydration, dehydration, dehydration. Campbell is one of 25 tribe members who live in the Timba Shoshone's ancestral homeland on the valley floor. Most have been there since birth. This heat is nothing new to us, she said. We know how to hunker down inside our homes and try to stay cool. Now the tribe members have air conditioning. They live here year-round. But Campbell's ancestors had the good sense to decamp to higher elevations during the hot months. They built a camp of summer homes on the shoulders of one of the park's peaks centuries ago. It's 80 degrees up there right now, Campbell said. It's nice. The Timba Shoshone had been in Death Valley for more than 1,000 years when white settlers arrived during the gold rush. The environment proved difficult for the extractive industries. Less than a century later, a major mining company in the area pivoted to tourism. One of its executives lobbied Herbert Hoover to make Death Valley a national monument in 1933. Its first superintendent spoke openly about his desire to remove the Timba Shoshone. In 1957, after tribe members had left the valley floor for the summer, the park staff called in fire trucks and ordered them to turn their hoses on the tribe's adobe buildings. Many of their walls were reduced to mud. Only six remain, including three that house tribe members to this day. Despite this history, Campbell told me that she personally has had a good relationship with the park now that some of the tribe's land has been returned. "We have to work together to protect this place," she said, but she remains irked by the name Death Valley. "They called it that because they didn't care for this place," she said. "Their settlers weren't making it here. But there is nothing dead about this valley. It is alive. There is plenty of food. My ancestors hunted bighorn sheep here. They hunted rabbits. They collected mesquite beans and ground them into flour to make bread. They knew where all the springs were. They had their trails, their ways. That's how they were able to survive." Campbell's aunt, Pauline Esteves, was the driving force behind the tribe's effort to reclaim its land from the U.S. government. She served as both chief archivist and negotiator. I asked Campbell about her. "I must have slipped into that subtle tone you use when you assume that someone is dead." "She is still alive," Campbell said, almost in retort. "She will be 100 in December. Esteves lives only a few houses away from the tribal office, as do two of the tribe's other eldest elders. They're tougher than us," Campbell said, and then she started to laugh. "When the electricity goes out in the summer, we are screaming to leave, but not the elders. All they want is a wet sheet to be put over them. They don't want to go nowhere." Now, a health article. "The Sad Future of Grocery Shopping" by Yasmin Tayag. A well-stocked grocery store is a wondrous place among the gleaming pyramids of fruit, golden rows of bread, and freezers crammed with ice cream. Time and space collapse. A perfectly ripe apple might have been picked a year ago. A cut of beef may have come from an Australian cow. Grocery stores defy seasons and geography to assure shoppers that they can have anything they want, any time. For a moment last year, these promises no longer seemed to hold up. The egg case at my local supermarket was stripped bare. Bird flu had decimated chickens across the country, and the egg supply with it. Americans hoarded whatever eggs they could find. Bird flu is a unique extreme case, but food shortages of all kinds keep hitting the grocery store. In recent months, olive oil, cocoa, and orange juice have all been in short supply, sending prices skyrocketing. The problem is largely climate change. Olive oil has more than doubled in cost over the past 2 years because drought and bad weather in the Mediterranean have shriveled olive groves. So many orange trees in Brazil are diseased and weakened by heat and drought that producers have considered making juice from other fruit. High temperatures have even made it harder to control the spread of bird flu, contributing to that egg crisis. These aren't isolated events. Peanuts, sugar, vanilla, and beef, among other foods, have also been in short supply at points over the past few years. "We are entering an age of disruption," Evan Fraser, a food systems expert at the University of Guelph in Canada, told me. "Soon, Americans may no longer be able to count on supermarkets that are perpetually stocked with cheap food. The era of grocery abundance is ending, and a more somber one is taking its place. The magic of the supermarket is that it hides the inherent variability of agriculture. Stable weather is one of the major factors necessary to keep supermarkets well-stocked," Fraser said, "and its future is not looking good with climate change. Heat, drought, flooding, and other climate effects are making it harder to grow crops, and importing them from elsewhere isn't always an option. That certain crops are grown in just a few areas in the world have made the food especially susceptible to shortages. An ongoing surge in sugar prices in the United States is being driven by unusually dry conditions in India and Thailand, where much of the global crop is harvested. And in March, a cyclone hit Madagascar, the world's biggest vanilla producer, threatening about half its harvest. Climate change is also worsening the conditions that allow pests and disease to thrive. along with heat and water-related stress, it's very clear globally that both are becoming more common. David Lobel, a professor and the director of Stanford University's Center on Food Security and the Environment, told me, over the past two decades, Florida's orange and grapefruit production has plummeted more than 75% because of citrus greening and infection spread by tiny bugs. That is now also ravaging fruit in Brazil. What makes climate change so troubling is that it affects so many aspects of the food system. Cargo ships stuck in massive seaside traffic jams due to low water levels caused by climate change are holding up food deliveries. Events such as the war in Ukraine, which curtailed production of wheat, the country's major export, may not have any obvious connection to the climate, but they're happening on top of a baseline. All of this means higher prices and patchy supply. It's already happening, but you might not have noticed. Inflation has masked some of the price hikes. In some cases, climate-related shortages can be remedied by importing food from places that aren't affected. For basic commodity crops such as cocoa, wheat, and coffee, price increases may seem minor compared to what's happening on the farms themselves. These goods are typically stockpiled, which means there's usually a backup supply to draw from if there's a shortage, softening any upticks in price. The sheer range of products available allows most shortages to be sidestepped painlessly. Shoppers can swap olive oil for canola. Cheesemakers can substitute mandarins for oranges. Food companies also have tricks so that you don't notice the food shortages. In March, Cadbury confirmed that it had downsized one of its chocolate bars because cocoa has become more expensive thanks to poor harvest. Americans will feel the squeeze eventually as the planet warms. Already, drought-related shortages of avocados in Mexico, which is responsible for 90% of the U.S. supply, have meant less guacamole during the Super Bowl. When reserves of commodity goods run out, prices will rise. This is expected to happen with cocoa in the next few years. Perishable goods can't be stored away in case of emergency. Even ubiquitous banana isn't immune to rising prices. Higher temperatures are worsening the spread of catastrophic fungal disease. Of course, poorer Americans will bear the brunt of rising costs. Perhaps the most devastating toll for Americans may be psychological. The idea the supermarket was based and is still based on endless abundance. All of that bounty has long assured Americans that food is plentiful and affordable, shaping our approach to eating, cooking, and shopping. It's the reason you can look up a recipe today and likely have all the ingredients for it tomorrow. But the grocery is transforming. Shoppers once walked in thinking, "What do I want?" The more salient question may be, "What can I have?" We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.